Hello and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host Matt Kuhlman, and in this episode I'll be talking with Jennifer Schmidt. Jennifer earned her BA in Studio Art and Art History from the University of Delaware in 1997, her MFA from the School of Art Institute of Chicago in 1999, and is a full-time faculty member at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Many of Jennifer's pieces involve using found patterns and imagery to create abstract graphic images. These principles are often directly applied to performance, multimedia, and video work. Join me as Jennifer explains how these pieces function in exploring broad topics such as identity, objectivity, inference, and the importance of context. Hi Jennifer, how are you doing today?
Good.
Thanks
nice
for
to meet you.
Yeah. And so I noticed looking through your work that you have obviously a lot of pattern-based stuff going on in it. And just to start with, what was your initial draw to pattern work as an art device? And like, what does it kind of mean to be able to use different patterns?
That's an interesting question. I didn't actually start thinking about it in terms of pattern. Mm-hmm. I think I started thinking about like the imagery that I was choosing more in terms of the ability to respond to it in terms of repetition,
mm-hmm.
or thinking about how like printmaking or an action would relate to creating a pattern or creating a sequence
mm-hmm.
of events or marks.
Yeah. And how long ago was it that you like became interested in this as a muse, I guess, or that mode of thought?
I think I really started delving into it around 2000.
Mm-hmm. And before that, were you just kind of doing undergrad level work?
No, before 2000, I was in grad school at the Art Institute of Chicago
mm-hmm.
in print media, and that's when I was first introduced to working with the computer, actually,
mm-hmm.
and working with Photoshop. And so I was like using repetition and patterning in that I was like sampling from my own photographs of sculptures I was making, and I was replicating them
okay.
to make like architectural plans
mm-hmm.
using the same object over and over again. So that, I guess that was probably like a beginning of thinking about like patterning and plan.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until 2000 when I moved to Boston that I started working with like coupon dashes and thinking
yeah.
about like graphic imagery as a way to create I guess like graphic signifiers that would indicate some kind of pattern sequence or
mm-hmm.
way to respond to something.
Can you describe one of those like earlier pieces in specific? Because I was just kind of curious to know like what this was coming out of, because it's not the type of work that obviously somebody just jumps right into doing from the beginning. It's something that's built up to
mm-hmm.
like it's very developed, I guess is what I'm saying. But like what were you doing kind of to bridge the gap that started your current series? Because I was looking through your website and it's got like a lot of your work goes back really far. I was like digging through, I was like, wow, this is extensive work on like the same kind of logical thought process,
mm-hmm.
like the kind of creating of composites of architectural sculptures, you said, or something.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think like when I was in Chicago, I didn't really realize exactly what I was doing, but I started out by one of the early projects I did as a student was mapping by doing rubbings of the sidewalk kind of in between where my apartment was and the Art Institute.
Mm-hmm.
It was creating like these really large tracing paper pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like this repetitive gesture, this action,
mm-hmm.
This performative action of tracing over my own footsteps or where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
And I also did a project at that time that involved an elevator installation that was called Transaction. And I took these for sale signs that you would see like for sale by owner in people's yards, and I printed them myself using an offset press as decals and covered the interior of the elevator so that it essentially became this transaction or this event, when people went in the elevator, it said for sale. And then when they mm-hmm. turned around in the elevator and the doors closed, it said sold.
Yeah.
But I wasn't, I don't think I was completely aware of what I was doing then. And actually it was, I think about this all the time, especially when I'm teaching, like none of my instructors ever kind of mentioned the word performance or that I was creating these literal mm-hmm. transactions that involved a participant, which was the viewer.
Yeah, I was interested in like the kind of conceptual elements of like what would make you want to like trace the sidewalk that you walk on. Like, is it a place thing or is it a process thing? Or
I think it was everything. And I think I was really trying to connect with my everyday experience and my everyday experience of a city that I was still getting to know, involving signage and like moving to Chicago to the Midwest from the Mid-Atlantic. And just kind of, you know, noticing the markings that construction workers are making on the sidewalk with arrows and,
yeah, those spray paint marks,
you know, taking the metro there and responding to that kind of graphic layout. And then, so I was doing these things that were like just trying to make sense of my environment. And then later when I moved away and for my thesis show, things became much more like, much more graphic in terms of like the printed imagery that I was making.
Mm-hmm.
So when I moved to Boston, I did this piece called Coupon Plan, and I took the coupon dash and I basically made a maze out of it that was digitally printed.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the real first piece I've done that's led to like a lot of the other work that I'm doing right now, because it involved like...
Was that one just a pure digital composite?
It was, but it had the scissors, like a scissors icon embedded within the overall coupon dash of the line, which was like an indicator of how you're supposed to read it or what you're supposed to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that imagery was then picked up a couple years later by this curator artist, Gary Cacciadorian in Baltimore. He did a project called Test Patterns, which related to the city of Baltimore and like putting signage and artwork on buses and bus shelters. Mm-hmm. And he liked that piece. He liked that graphic design. So I was able to put it on a bus and on a bus shelter, and it kind of ended up mimicking the plan of a city in the way you would navigate some kind of consumer culture or like clip your way through.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned right before we started interviewing that you do a lot of your work in residencies now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested in one of the most recent ones, I guess, was Russian Condo. Is that what it was called?
Post-Soviet condo.
Post-Soviet condo, something. Yeah. Uh-huh. Can you explain exactly what was happening there? Because I saw the photos and I wasn't sure like how much of the environment you manipulated, because it looked like there might have been some wood construction that went along with the obvious wall that you put the pattern on in there and stuff. But just what was the setting and things, too?
I didn't manipulate anything.
Yeah.
I like doing my work in terms of residencies, especially site-specific residencies that are at a particular place where you're open to responding to the location or to the culture in some way, because for me, it's a way to like really like link and locate my work in that particular experience of being there.
Mm-hmm.
And so last summer, I was able to go to the Nida Art Colony that is in Lithuania, and it's on the Kronian Spit, which is a spit of sand or land that's on the Baltic Sea. And it has a really interesting history in that after World War II, when Russia and the other countries that were involved in World War II were making their peace settlements and their agreements, the spit was divided in half. So there's a Russian border on the spit. And so there's this chunk of Russia, which also involves like Königsberg, which is now Kaliningrad, which is separated from the rest of Russia. And then there's Lithuania, which is a Baltic country, which is, what am I trying to get at? Anyway, you can't cross the border. And this residency is right next to the border.
Yeah.
And after the break, when Lithuania became its own free country, separate from the Soviet Union, a lot of things happened in their economy and in the real estate market, because they went from being essentially communist or people living in these state-built apartment houses to people owning property. And as I was wandering around Nida and like trying to make sense of where I was, I came across this really odd building that is located right next to the beach. And the other thing I should say is that this whole area is parkland. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So you can't build there.
Okay.
You can't just build whatever you want. And here is this building that's abandoned, surrounded by trees, right next to the beach, mm-hmm. that everyone's just walking by to go to the ocean and ignoring.
How big is it, actually? Is
it, it was like a condo complex where there were these square-like buildings that were connected. Probably about, like, I'm thinking, like, maybe eight of them that seemed identical in floor plan.
Uh-huh.
But the construction and the architecture of the building is amazing.
Yeah.
The wood that you were describing.
Yeah, it had, like, the slatted patterns.
Yeah, like, I mean, it is totally, like, you know, Russian constructivist painting, but, like, in architectural form, in that there were all these diamond-like triangular forms. The walls were made of glass. And in the inside, you have these wood panels and wood carpentry that are making up these really interesting geometric forms. So when I walked in there, I just thought, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And everything had been placed in there, even though it was falling apart, in a way that also seemed like it was a composition. So I had this poster design that I had been working on that was based on Battleship of Potemkin compositions, which involves this diamond-like form of lines intersecting. And I had screen printed them, and I had brought them with me with the idea that, like, maybe I would do something with them, but if I couldn't find something that related to the content of what they were, then I was going to abandon the project. And I had already used this poster design for another project here in New York called Workshop for the Constructivists. So when I went in this building, it was like, oh, this design really fits well with this actual, this, like, literally visual composition of this building and the time in which it might have been made, and the idea that it has since, like, kind of been abandoned, probably because the money fell out from underneath it post-break. And so I found these little rooms that were floating within these large open floor plans that basically look like bathrooms or closets, but for some reason they were finished more than the rest of the building with drywall and plaster, and I made my own wheat paste and I wallpapered them so they look like these finished interior spaces.
So it was several locations throughout the
Yes. So what's tricky about the piece, like so many other things that I make, is that if you're not there, it's kind of hard to really have the experience of navigating the space and finding them. It's the problem with, like, site specific or work that's more like guerrilla or interventionist.
Yeah, that was the thing. Just, like, looking at the photos, it was hard to tell, like, scale, or, like, am I only looking at one wall that's, like, from different angles?
Right. Yeah, that's why I ended up, there were two artists that were at the residency who were Polish from Finland, and they were amazing cinematographers, and they helped me shoot a video that's more exploratory in nature as you approach the building and wander through.
Yeah.
And I feel like if that piece is to be shown, really that video is the piece at this point, along with, like, some printed ephemera.
Yeah. And there was another piece that you did at the same spot that was something with speakers on the beach with sound wave. You created, like, a barrier on the border there.
Yeah, so that piece is called Wave Boundary, and it also plays off of the geographic location of this spit of sand, and also the fact that the Russian border is about 50 feet beyond where those speakers were placed on the beach. What's weird about having a Russian border on a beach like that, or cutting off, like, this isthmus of sand, is that...
Is it, like, a fenced-off thing? Like,
there are warning signs that say, stop, do not go further. And it's like a nature preserve before it is a buffer. But you could very easily just walk over.
Yeah, there's not, like, armed guards standing there.
No, but there is a guard tower in the distance that you can see. I think you can see it if you look at the photo of the speakers. But, like you need special visas to go to Russia, so it's a big deal. Like, if you were to cross over, you'd be detained, and dealing with a whole other country's rules. But because that border's there, it turns the spit of sand into an island. And so what I did is I recorded the waves right there at that spot using my digital recorder, and then I'm playing them back through these two big speakers so that as you would walk along the beach, you'd hear, like, the normal wave pattern to your right, but then slowly this other pattern would be confronting you from the front. Mm-hmm. And essentially, you would notice something was slightly different geographically about where you were.
Okay.
And, like, your sense of pacing would be different. And then when you get really close to the speakers and it becomes obvious, it feels like a surround,
mm-hmm.
a surround sound, like you're on an island.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was interested in. I was interested in kind of transforming the physical space sonically to reflect what was going on there.
Yeah. Are there many people around that were able to, like, experience this out in this kind of remote area, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky when I was at this residency in that one of the reasons I wanted to go there is that it's run by the Lithuanian Art School in Vilnius, and they bring groups of students out from Germany and Sweden and
mm-hmm.
Finland and Lithuania to work together on thematic type proposals and projects. And there was a whole group of people there at the time who were there for this seminar on memory, and they came.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not in the picture because I wanted to get a view of the speakers just kind of against the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
They're all behind me.
Yeah.
Like they made the pilgrimage. They walked up the beach as though they didn't really know what they were going to expect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the other part of this project that limits its exposure is that we had to haul a generator out there through the no man's zone. So it ran for like an hour and a half, and that was the maximum it could run on gasoline, which was also kind of like ridiculous, but fed into the project.
I can't remember, did you do any other like audio projects in your work previous to that?
Mm-hmm.
Did you? What are some of those projects? I didn't get a chance to investigate those too much.
Well, in the beginning, I got involved with working with audio by teaching at the museum school and becoming interested in doing video. And I started to collaborate with a recent graduate who's a musician who still lives in Boston. His name is Colin Asquith.
Mm-hmm.
And Colin helped me learn how to record with like a mini disc recorder and various mics, checking out stuff from the stockroom at school to record the soundtrack for my video Scantron.
Mm-hmm.
And started really thinking about space and kind of contextualizing what the action or the event was through recording sound related to that action.
Mm-hmm.
And so he and I worked together for several years, probably about 5 years in various projects. And then we worked on a project with another sound artist named Terry Nauheim, who lives in New York, on this audio greeting card project
mm-hmm.
called Wish You Were Here. And that was, it's basically a sound bank that's
yeah.
very much like lo-fi. You know, we recorded all these different sound samples related to different places and embedded them in these cards so that when you open the cards using these card racks, it becomes this site.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started getting really interested in like sound as sound
mm-hmm.
as a material. So I would say that like I still am active in recording sound for video projects, but I also really kind of think about sound on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So my work in some ways is kind of split between working with like visual iconography and graphic design and then like creating projects that are also just very much about like the invisible and what it is that you're experiencing
mm-hmm.
sonically.
In the wave boundary one, there's the obvious tie into like the kind of pattern based work with the waves kind of repetitively
right.
crashing. Did you try to include some of that in the Wish You Were Here project, or what kind of sound compilation would come out when you open the card? It's just kind of like one of those birthday cards, right, where you open up it.
Right.
Like, happy
and
birthday.
We ordered white cards, and you can see the speaker module on the inside, but that's it. So
mm-hmm.
it had this very minimal kind
yeah,
of representation.
Very cool.
But what was interesting about that project for me, I mean, I would say my main input to that project was kind of that format,
mm-hmm.
kind of thinking about that card and what that meant, having something inside of it as a gesture. But what I was also interested in is how the repetition or the patterning, if you want to call it that, of the way these sounds were played and overlapped and like brought together to make a sound composition had everything to do with whoever was holding it in their hand.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's an image of Colin on my website playing with these cards where he's using the racks a little bit more like someone who'd be like a DJ or sampling from all these different sounds.
It's like opening up a bunch of...
You can open them
ones.
Quickly, you can close it really quickly and like muffle the sound and it stops.
Mm-hmm.
They only play, I think, for like 40 seconds each.
Yeah.
So you can repeat. There's some that are like zippers. You can repeat it over and over again. Whereas there's others that are, would be like recording at Coney Island of seagulls going by.
Yeah.
And so that becomes really interesting to me. And like, it's also based on chance, like whoever's standing around the racks and who chooses to pick up one card versus another, they have no idea what they're about to open.
Yeah.
And in some ways it was kind of baffling for them because we showed this piece originally at SIGGRAPH, which is this tech conference in California. And people didn't understand why it was so low-tech when everything else there was like... This was like before 3D television became really popular, but people were demoing it.
Yeah. Did you find that people like spent time like trying to figure it out or explore it and like open a bunch of cards, or were they just kind of like baffled and then like, I don't know what's going on?
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, it's an app, children love it because it's like, it's very playful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think any work where you're asking someone to come up and literally browse and touch the things that you have out also has problems, mm-hmm. and that people don't always feel comfortable doing that. So you have to give them permission.
Yeah.
You know, you have to tell them somewhere that it's okay. That piece also traveled to Canada to be part of, what's it called? New Adventures in Sound Art on Toronto Island.
Mm-hmm.
And it was installed in a church. And they put the cards, I think, in the pews, which is kind of weird.
Yeah.
I mean, that conceptually doesn't make sense to me to put a greeting card in a pew. But on the other hand, it's kind of cool to think about people going into a church and sitting down and opening like a hymnal.
Yeah.
So if it was in a different form, that could be interesting.
Yeah, make musical auto hymnals. You just open up and it plays the music.
Yeah, I mean, I like that idea of something being discovered, found, and experienced that's unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And you referenced a piece, Scantron, earlier that you was one of the first ones,
mm-hmm.
video, or it involved audio, is what the gist of you were talking about was. But what was that piece? Because I saw the still image. I wasn't aware that it was a video, though. So
it started out as a print.
Okay.
It was an offset. We used to have an offset press at Museum School, which I was really interested in because I'd done some work with that previously, where you can make a lot of something.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is that like the print is not precious at all. It's about distribution and quotes something that's already in the world. So I decided that I would make my own Scantron test, just taking the visual iconography of a Scantron test and replicating it as a patterned image, A, B, C, D, E, with ovals. And I created drawings not to make visual imagery that looked like anything, but thinking more about someone like John Cage and like playing with chance and giving myself some simple rules. And
yeah, that's kind of what I read from it, was just, I kind of imagined you like John Cage, like rolling dice or something to decide like what was going to happen next or something.
Well, the simple rules were that it was done over like a 2-month period of time in winter, and I had to respond to the test in the same way that you would to a normal Scantron test, where use a number 2 pencil, no stray marks, choose one answer per line. But what I was also very interested in terms of the Scantron test form, like as a graphic design or as an object, is that it exists separate in the world from the test itself.
Yeah.
So really, you can't read that. You can't read that form unless you have a master or some way to respond to it. And the way it's read is by putting it into like essentially a computer, this mechanical device that reads it against something else. And if you have a stray mark, it's going to read it wrong. So I liked all of those things that were kind of building up.
Mm-hmm.
So I made, I think there are like 55 of them in the series, and they're like 12 and a half by 17 inches, I think. They're fairly large. Made these drawings and then scanned them back into the computer in my own low-tech way, and then in the order that they were drawn and scanned, dumped them into Final Cut and animated them.
Okay.
Okay, so I wasn't trying to go for something particular, and I let the imagery play itself out, and then the sounds that were recorded in that space where I was doing the mark making. And that was composed. But what I've decided is what's important about that piece is the video. The drawings are quite nice, but I don't think it's important or necessary to show the drawings with the video. It's the record.
Yeah, so the final, you just see the answers constantly, like, changing.
Right. It almost becomes, like, static.
what are some other video works that you've done then?
Well, probably the most recent one that I did was this piece called Feeling Plaid that I made this year.
Okay, I saw that, but again, I didn't realize that was also a video.
That's based on prints.
Okay.
So, like, all of my videos, for the most part, unless it's like a documentation, are not shot in camera. They're made with print media that's been animated. Because I'm always, even though my background is in print and in print media, I'm always trying to kind of show an aspect of printmaking or the what it means to repeat a gesture in a way that is different from just staring at the printed object.
Yeah.
Like, I have real trouble with that. I'm always trying to escape it, and yet I can't help but make these prints or use this kind of language in my work. So Feeling Plaid was a series of screen prints that were made all in one session, where I took a basic plaid pattern and I was thinking about screensavers and how benign they are on computers.
Yeah.
And also the idea of a plaid pattern and the use of color. And I wanted to modulate that while printing. So, like, the printing process becomes a performative act where I'm changing the hue of the red on the screen as I'm screen printing, changing the hue of yellow and blue. And so what I ended up with, I think there are 28 in all. They're all slightly different gradations or shades and hues of the same colors. And they belong together, like, as a big suite. And I scan those into the computer and animated them. And it becomes the shifting screensaver.
Yeah, is that also just kind of the same interest in the Cagean kind of thought of just kind of randomness and structure combining to form something?
Well, this one's a little bit different than John Cage in that it's more about, like, the pattern, like, the idea of, like, a visual image or the use of, like, a motif or something that is otherwise considered benign. Even though plaids do have, like, significance, like, in certain
cultures.
Yeah,
there's a meaning in, like, the cultural aspect from Scotland, right? Like, each clan has their own.
Yeah, I think several different cultures. But this piece didn't end up being so much about that as much about, like, the idea of, like, the shifting color and making something that otherwise would be, like, decorative, be emotive. Emotive with an E. Like,
yeah.
By animating it.
And a lot of your pieces kind of involve some kind of process element to them, you keep saying. And there was one that I noticed that was called Pinstripes. Where it sounded like a very labor-intensive process. Can you describe what you were doing with that project there?
That one's different in that it is about the object in the end. I went to Mood Fabrics here in New York, and I bought some really nice men's pinstripe shirt fabric, like you would have a dress shirt made out of to work in an office. And I was kind of interested in, like, what that material, the fabric, signified in terms of value for occupation. And then I brought it home and I traced the lined pattern of that pinstripe with a blue Sharpie. So there's, like, 3 yards of each by the length of this table. And created my own kind of, like, tracing or ghost drawing on top of the fabric that was already made and woven and made of, like, special silk threads. And and then after that, I had it professionally, what is the word, where somebody tailored it, but I didn't have it tailored into something functional or wearable, like a shirt. I had it tailored into, like, essentially, like, a shroud. Or, like, the edges were tailored as though the edge of your shirt sleeves would be tailored.
Like, hemmed over.
Yes. And there's, like, a line of buttonholes on one side and a line of buttons on the other. And the idea is that this could be used in multiple ways to create, like, shelter,
like,
or to drape.
Like a business name tube top or something.
Right. Or, like, to create, like, some, like a tent. But the way they're presented is, like, they're very nicely ironed and folded. There's 3 of them.
Yeah, they
and they
kind of
sit
like
presented like
stuff.
They're in a store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it about kind of creating a product, then, you said? Or it was more about the object than that one?
It's about value, economies of value and labor. And I think kind of thinking about, like, I mean, I've been... When did I make that? Was that last year? I've been doing that I did that piece and some other pieces during this whole economic recession that's been happening.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Occupy Wall Street, things that have been happening here in New York and around the world,
mm-hmm.
you know, the mortgage crisis. Like, you know, it's been kind of seeping into my work indirectly. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about, like, the role of the artist and what that means in terms of labor in relationship to the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And some other pieces that we haven't talked about yet. So you had a bunch of pieces that involve found samples of text, was that right, where you conglomerated them into different phrases and things. I didn't read a whole lot of, I looked through them, I didn't read the description too much though, so do you want to explain your process there and what you're doing with those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I often, I mean, with my projects, some people's sketchbooks are full of drawings, and mine tend to be full of words. And often my work will start with a title before I even make it. And in this case, and so actually going back to what you initially started out with in terms of patterning or repetition, I mean, a lot of the work that I do is actually about sampling, like finding some kind of source for something that I become intrigued by and then explore. And so with the projects that you're talking about, Matter of Fact and Found Parable, they're both letterpress projects, which are poetry projects as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they're found poetry. And they're found poetry based on translation. So it's this book that I found that is like a Scribe and Lazy Fable, which is like a children's handwriting book from a German-American, Pennsylvania, Dutch children's handwriting book where you learn how to write your ABCs, you learn how to write sentences, and the German translation to English is, it's very, I mean, it's legible and it's it makes sense, but it's also kind of odd in this poetic way that it's like, it's teaching, it, when I read it, I thought, wow, this is like teaching some kind of moral lesson. And I became really interested in the way the words were organized. And what I did is I took passages and then I didn't change the word order, but I changed the way in which you would read them into, like, you know, three statements or three sentences and added punctuation.
Mm-hmm. Did you add images with that one? I can't remember.
No.
Were there
no, it's solely letterpress, so it becomes more about the typography that's chosen and what is actually being said and an interpretation of that.
How would it be encountered? Would it be, like, hanging on a wall in a gallery, or would it be, like, okay...
Yeah, those are presented as prints where I think the Matter of Fact series, there's like three prints, three poems, and it's black letterpress typography on white paper, and they're framed within white frames and they hang stacked on top of each other.
Several pieces there. What are some of the other ones that have you done recently at residencies that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, I would say that there's a few. I mean, so there was the one last year, and then a couple years ago I got to go to Bumpkin Island off the coast of Boston.
Okay.
One of the harbor islands, and that was a project that was proposed with Meg Rotzel and Sarah Baumert. They're both Boston artists working in Boston. And we proposed to go there as a collective and do work. And really the collectivity of our project was that there were like several projects happening within a clearing on the island. What was unique about that project or being there is that we were only there for like 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
You could only bring so many things onto the island that had to fit on a pallet that was a certain size on the boat. We were camping. There were all these like physical restrictions, and also there's no electricity.
Sounds pretty rugged.
And yet, you could see, at night, you could see the lights of Boston from the island, so it's pretty special. So I did a project for that where I sewed a sail before I got there. I took this muslin that I had screen printed on and sewed a sail, kind of thinking about the island as like this floating boat or floating vessel within the harbor. And I had two wooden poles. And when we were in the clearing on the island, myself and Meg or Sarah, we took turns, would be on either side of the sail, running it back and forth, essentially like fanning the island as though we were making the island move. Mm-hmm. And there was something really kind of like, Viking isn't the word, but like, it was like female power, I don't know, about us running this thing back and forth and making the fabric lift off the island. So that was specific to that place.
Yeah, it sounds like kind of a ritual or something.
It was. Yeah. There was a that word repetition. There was literally a repetition to the way we would lift the fabric off the ground and fan it a few times, and then how many times we would go back and forth, and then stop, and then start again.
And there was the residency in Alaska that you mentioned you had done, right?
That residency is called the Homestead AK Residency, and I had the opportunity to go out there in 2010 for, I think it was 2.5 weeks, and it was isolated. It was one of those situations where you dealt with the location, it was about the environment, it was about what you had on you and what you could get for your projects. So I ended up doing a sound project there. And a project that involved light, involving like a found car mirror. There's a project that I did that was like in collaboration with another artist who you've interviewed previously, Garrett Yon. He wasn't there at the time, but he made a workstation, which was basically hauling a really heavy metal desk, like a military desk, out into the woods to the bog. And putting it down and like building a platform for it with the idea that it could be used as a place to sit and work on something or like meditate on the environment. And I found it, and it was like, it was a stage. And it was a stage looking out on a bog that was occupied by these sandhill cranes who were not happy that I was there. Which was kind of the whole experience of the homestead and thinking about homesteading, is that this building, this house, this land was like mowed and built out of the landscape.
What's kind of the setting? Is it like way out off the beaten path out there?
Well, everything feels a little bit off the beaten path in that
it's Alaska.
It's Alaska. Like we flew into the airport and we were picked up by Chuck Cheney, who runs the residency, in this big Suburban. And we went to like a big box store and loaded up on food. And like drove for hours to the homestead,
so up this far out there.
Up this dirt road. There was nowhere you could walk to. Like you needed a car, so you're kind of stuck on the land. And then you get there, and it used to be owned by his dad. And there are like all these old cars, like tons of old cars, tons of junk, tons of bicycles, old washing machines, like other metal things just laying around. That have since been kind of organized by people who have gone there, but it's still kind of like a junkyard that's not rusting.
Yeah.
In the middle of this beautiful space with these trees and like moss, and supposedly there are bear there and moose. And so I was also told like not to go beyond a certain line, like not to go beyond the trees because there was wildlife.
Yeah.
And to be careful. So I was also kind of scared and petrified and like not familiar with where I was. So I found this desk and it seemed like a good place to be, and I sat down and there were these cranes walking in this diagonal zigzag pattern screeching at me, and I realized that I was the visitor. Like I was occupying their territory. And then at the same time there was this metal junkyard or metal alley that I was just describing, and I would go out there with the other residents and we would like play with the different objects, like hitting them with different tools to make sounds. And I decided that I was going to use a shovel as my chosen instrument, and I started playing car hoods with a shovel and recording myself. using my digital recorder. So I recorded this sequence after practicing for several days and then ran an amp with a really long extension cord out into the bog to this work site that Garrett had set up,
mm-hmm.
and used it as a stage to respond to the sandhill cranes and blasted it into the bog. And there's, I mean, you don't hear anything out there other than like your own actions and
yeah.
whatever's going on with the wildlife. So it was really loud and really disturbing, and it kind of summed up my experience or my thoughts about us even kind of being there
yeah.
in the space.
How'd the cranes react to it?
They didn't respond. The mosquitoes loved it.
Really?
Alaska's also like the land of mosquitoes. They were really attracted to all the electrical equipment.
There, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember the piece I was thinking of earlier again. It was you created a room that had this red logarithmic pattern of some type. It was like a wallpaper that you made, basically. And
what did the wallpaper look like?
I was like kind of red blocky objects.
Oh, okay.
And it covered like the entire
uh-huh.
room. What was that piece?
Okay, that piece is called Pastures and Hedges, and I made that at Syracuse University.
So that's a pretty old one, right?
No, that's 2 years old.
Okay.
Yeah. I was able to go to Syracuse University as an artist in residence for a week, which was wonderful. They helped me make work while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested at the time in like using geometric components like you would in quilting, thinking about quilt design.
Mm-hmm.
I like this idea in general of like just basic forms that become reconfigured and mean different things or create different kinds of visual imagery depending on the context.
Mm-hmm.
So there were three designs that were made using cut black construction paper that were screen printed large, with the idea that the three designs, the three posters, were interchangeable. You could flip the paper in any direction and they would match in the corners
mm-hmm.
to make a pattern.
Okay.
So the piece that you saw is, it's a really large gallery. Also, it's like a hallway space people walk through that I think is about 75 feet long by 25 feet wide by maybe like 13 feet high in the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to play with the pattern and the sequence throughout the space. So it changes, but it never breaks.
Okay. So if you followed it, it'd be a continuous repetition all the way around. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, some people told me that it was, I don't know if overwhelming's the word, but it has this kind of gestalt feeling to it because it's red and white and it's really bold.
Yeah, it is bold and
big. It's not a relaxing space.
13 feet high walls probably big and imposing, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that's, I think with that piece, the rhythm of the patterning really ends up affecting you as you're moving through it.
Mm-hmm. That's about all the things I'm aware of your work. Were there other projects that you wanted to talk about that we haven't gotten to? Or?
Well, right now, the things that you're surrounded by are pieces that I'm getting ready to show as part of this printmaking residency at the Gowanus Studio Space here in
mm-hmm.
Brooklyn. And the show is opening at the end of January. And there are two projects that are kind of based on the same motif or the same design using stripes.
Mm-hmm.
And one is a peppermint candy pattern printed on white paper that's meant to be like a wrapping. So there's candy boxes that I made.
Nice.
And then
just in time for Valentine's
Day. Right, and you know, it says peppermint candy, Jennifer Schmidt 2012, and there's some candy in there. But then there's a crosshatch pattern, which is a wrapping or a print that's made on very thin tracing paper,
mm-hmm.
where as the line pattern is folded over, it creates a drawing.
Okay.
So you can create multiple versions of a crosshatch pattern drawing by overlapping the paper.
Make your eyes bug out.
Yeah. So with this project, I'm really interested kind of in like the making of a product and what it means to standardize something,
mm-hmm.
or how you know that that's a peppermint candy pattern
yeah.
versus a barbershop pattern mm-hmm. or something else. And they'll be shown on two different shelving systems that are like commercial store shelving systems
mm-hmm.
with then having like a poster version above it.
Okay. Cool. Well, thanks for talking to me today. Nice to know, learn more about your work, and see you around.
Okay, thanks.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Jennifer Schmidt. You can find her work online at jennifershmidt.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattcoolman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee that I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes, along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.